Hey everyone, welcome to the Grief Informed Podcast. I'm your host, Rachel Garcia, and this is a place where I bring you authentic conversations with people who are willing to share their journey through seasons of grief. No matter your cultural upbringing, societal conditioning, or faith practice, grief affects us all. Whether you're dealing with a loss, a diagnosis, a broken heart, or the everyday stressors of life, or love someone who is, these conversations are here to support you in that process. So be sure to check out the show notes for potential trigger warnings. And whether you're very comfortable with or deeply avoidant of grief and its many responses, you are welcome here. Thank you for being here, and now on to the episode. Hey everybody, welcome back to the Grief Informed Podcast. I'm your host, Rachel Garcia, and today I have with me a former client turned friend back from my doula days, Heather Sachs. Hello, thank you for being here.
I'm so excited. It's so fun.
And I've mentioned coming onto the podcast, I think it was in January of the beginning of this year, and we are now making it happen in October. Could not be more excited.
Yes.
Because honestly, you were the first person that came to my mind when I wanted to do this podcast.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
It's very humbling.
Literally the first person. So I am excited to tell how we met, how that came to be. How many years ago was that?
Well, Gideon is 12. But fun fact, because I was thinking about this, I knew who you were before you knew who I was, because I was done having kids at five, had five kids, and a friend, you were going to be her doula, and I was like, ooh, tell me more about doula, and so I was like intrigued by it, and I was like, I've got to find her, and so we actually went to Chick-fil-A with little kids in tow on 119, and shared, like, briefly, I asked you questions about the process while our kids
played,
or terrorized other people on the plate.
Contained place.
And then, funny story, I ended up pregnant with Gideon, and instantly you were the first call.
I love that. And you also, you and your husband, Cord, were in my first ever childbirth class that I taught.
That's right.
Yes, yes. It was a six-week class, and you guys were in there with Becky Urban.
Yes,
and
Becky.
Garrett, that, she was on the second or third episode of the podcast.
Yes.
And yeah, so that was pretty powerful. So your birth story is very memorable, which we have to share. Okay, so Cord was in the last class.
Yes.
And you had missed that class.
Yes. Judson, who was four at the time, had his tonsils out. And he was on, like why we thought it was a good idea to get his tonsils out.
Around your due date?
Yeah. Like, who does that? But I think we were sold this bill of sale that it'll only be, like, we do it a new way and laser it off, and it'll only be a few days recovery.
Yeah.
But, like, our air conditioner had gone out. We have this child that is screaming in pain and can't keep his pain medicine down because he won't drink anything, and was just not in a place that I could leave him. And so Cord said, well, I'll go and just tell you what you missed.
Yeah, yeah, which happened to be the last week was more hands-on. For the labor, like, we're going to practice some techniques. We're going to get you ready for, you're in the room. And and for my clients were also in a hospital setting. Mm-hmm. So you were intending to go to the hospital and intending to have an unmedicated birth. And so it was all hands on deck. Let's do the practices. He was there getting all the practical insight of how to at the very end. And then how many, I don't remember how many weeks after that.
It was
soon.
It's all kind of foggy.
Yeah.
But props to him for, like, taking one for the team and going. Because I remember he came home and I said, well, what did y'all learn? He's like, well, we learned a ton of hands-on stuff. And then, like, we watched a video on what to do if a baby came, like, precipitous or spontaneous, you know. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. Not a big deal. And, I mean, we already were like, it was so cute. On the first night of childbirth class, you had everyone go around and say your name and if this were your first kid or not. And I think almost everybody in there were like, we could have been their parents. I mean, we are like, Cord and Heather Sachs, and we have five kids. This is our sixth. Oh, gosh. It was like the Duggars. I mean, it was really embarrassing. And they're kind of like, did you not figure out how your baby comes out with the first five that you're here now?
Right, right.
But yeah, I wanted to go unmedicated. Yeah. So that's how we ended up there.
Yep. And then I get a call. I get a text from you on the day of birth. It was in the evening, and you said, hey, I've started contracting. Correct me if I'm wrong. And you said, I've started, you go. What happened? You texted me.
This is so fun to hear you tell it back because I have like bits and pieces that I remember.
Okay,
okay. I remember being super emotional and having maybe Braxton Hicks.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I was trying to get clothes into the washer and my belly was in the way. And every night it would be this way, like go to bed and
contract.
Is baby going to come tonight? Mm-hmm. Who's in town? I mean, it was right before school started, so we didn't have family in town at the time. So it's like take inventory of who could come. And
yep.
So I remember texting you that I was, you know, having some contractions, but I was just going to go to sleep.
Yep.
And so fast forward.
Really fast forward.
Really fast forward to 1 a.m. and my water broke. Mm-hmm. Which was nothing new. With all of my other pregnancies, my water would break.
But it is your sixth.
It was my sixth.
Yeah.
With all my other pregnancies, I go to the hospital and they start Pitocin because I don't contract on my own. And so we were just waiting on a friend to get there with the kids.
Yep.
And Court was videoing. I have like, I don't even know why I did these things, but I had a flower in my hair. I think it was a hair tie. And I remember seeing the video and he has the phone propped up. And I'm like counting my seconds. And I'm like, it's just not stopping. Like, it's not stopping. And he's like, looks at himself. Oh, boy, it's going to be a long night.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like cracking
himself
up. And I was like, no, I'm serious. And I'm like at 120.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, that was a big one.
Yeah.
I have to pee. And you may have to edit this out.
Hey, FYI, you're getting a birth story.
Trigger warning. So I was like, I had to pee. So I went into the bathroom and I heard our friend come to sit with the kids and who should not have been awake.
Yeah.
But it was 1 a.m. and Cord doesn't do much quiet.
Right.
And so I was like, I feel like I'm going to get sick. Get me something. Hello.
Yeah.
Contractions.
Yeah.
I mean, hello.
Very participus
later. Probably your key. You're getting sick that you might be in transition.
Yeah. And I think when your water broke, that's when he called me.
He called you.
Yeah. And I said, oh, okay.
I'll meet you at the hospital.
I'll meet you. Yeah. Y'all just go ahead and get ready. Mm-hmm. And we would not normally say that, but for the fact that it's your sixth baby, like it, we just have to count for it could be quick. And so I'm like, I'll meet you there.
Uh-huh.
And then I don't know if it was like 20 minutes later. I knew I was driving.
It was really close.
It was. I was at an intersection. So to my house, to the hospital was going to be about a 25, 30 minute drive. And then he called me right as I was at a main intersection where a decision point.
Yes.
And he said, hey, Rachel. Only said, this is my favorite quote ever. Hey, Rachel, Heather won't get in the truck.
I remember thinking, he is calling to tell on me because he had that tone, with the kids, you know, like, you're going to be in trouble.
It.
She's not doing it. And he had said, you need to come get in the truck. And I was like, I'm not moving
out of the bathroom. So then I said, Cord, where is she? And he's like, she's in the bathroom. These are the only questions. There's no dialogue. And I said, Cord, what position is she in the bathroom? And he said, she's on all fours. And you laugh. You like, because you know. And I was like, okay, Cord, here's what's going to happen. You're going to hang up the phone, and then you're going to call 911. You're going to hang up with them, and then you're going to get ready to catch your baby.
Exactly.
And he was like, no, I'm what?
And you said it just like that. Because he had you on speakerphone. Like, you were just as matter of fact and calm, and this is what's going to happen.
and at that traffic light, I just immediately, when he said she won't get in the truck, I think it may have been that question. I may have turned when I heard what position you were in. But either way, I turned right and had to make it to 119 and go down 119. And then as I'm driving up your big hill,
oh my gosh,
that I am behind the fire truck and the ambulance that were on their way. And I just kept thinking, I got to get in there before they do.
Yes.
I got to get it to her. And so I was like, I need to get in there. And I did. As soon as we pulled into the yard, I ran inside and I came in the house. just as you were pulling Gideon up onto your chest.
Oh my god.
Just this, like, and that was the first time I had ever experienced that as a doula.
You would have never known.
No. And you just, I just pull. Oh, that's sweet. Thank you. I was just not even thinking about you. And I watch you pull him up on your chest. And I was like, hey.
And then we burst out laughing. We were like,
I was like, you had your baby
on the bathroom floor. I was like, oh my gosh, we are the rednecks on the news. Oh my gosh.
No, it was amazingly beautiful and powerful. And you did an amazing job. And Cord, I heard he was great
he
too.
He was a champ.
Yes, at 1 a.m. in the morning.
1 a.m. sweating bullets with his sunglasses on his head.
Yes.
We went back and looked at notes. At 1 a.m. my water broke, and I think that's when we reached out to you. At 1:21 was the first contraction. Mm. And when the medics got there, I think they called it 1:40 on his birth certificate. So,
wow.
It was a quick one.
Yeah.
We would have been on the side of the road.
Yes, you would have, had you decided to get in the truck. But you were not. You were not going to move. Yep. But I want to say for everybody listening, this is the old doula, my doula hat on, that most moms who go unmedicated in a car, you see the videos where they're sitting in the front seat and right. they pull the baby out. But I have, anecdotally, I don't have research to show this, but typically moms get on all fours to right. to do that birth when it's like it's not planned, it's very primal, it's just you instinctually go to that position.
Absolutely.
And it's just amazing what the body is capable of doing, and you did amazing.
It really is fascinating, and there's no controlling it. Like, I remember the 911 operator saying, you know,
can you
tell her not to push. And I was like, and we were like, the head is out.
Yeah.
What in the world? I'm not doing anything. Like,
this big muscle is moving on its own.
This is arching my back. Like something from Poltergeist.
Oh, that is so good.
Oh, yeah.
And then what's amazing after that is that you became a doula for yourself. You also got certified and became a doula. And how long after that was that?
About 2.5-3 years.
Yeah. Oh my goodness.
My very first birth was shadowing you.
Oh, I don't really? Mm-hmm. I don't remember that.
I don't think I did anything but fan this sweet little mama who was having her fourth literally the whole time, and they were so thankful.
Oh,
I remember
of course.
Thinking I didn't do anything, but Rachel is the real MVP here.
No.
It was fascinating to watch you.
Your presence alone in a room. I mean, I have not gotten to witness you as a doula, but I can imagine it's the most amazing thing. Just the most encouraging woman and gifted and skilled in people and communication and gentleness. You're great. You're great.
That's a gift. Your words are a gift. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm so glad you're here. Okay.
I know.
So, all right. From there, mm-hmm. I want to ask, can you tell us what your cultural upbringing and background is?
Yes. So I grew up in a very traditional home, mom and dad, little brother, the boy and the girl kids, you know. So we blew our family's minds when we had six, of course. My dad was a Southern Baptist pastor, so we traveled a lot, like kind of all over the South. But I have great memories growing up. We didn't have a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I remember times just really having to trust God for stuff. Yeah. But my parents had a great marriage and a good relationship with us, and I never felt like – I felt like I was in a fishbowl just by being a pastor's daughter, but they never made me feel like I had to perform or be something I was not.
Yeah.
They gave me the freedom to be my own person and make the mistakes and learn to grow up like everyone else, which was really a gift.
Yeah. So, oh, that's awesome. And then how did you meet Cord?
On a summer beach project.
Oh, summer beach project. Okay.
Yeah.
That's a college, for those that don't know, that's like a college. I did one in 98.
Okay.
The summer before my dad died. When were you on beach project?
I was on, you're a baby. I was on a 94, 95, and then 97.
And he went on staff, right?
He did.
Yeah. The campus outreach, which is a non-denominational, how would you describe
college ministry?
So you met on project. Mm-hmm. And then he was on staff. Y'all got married. Yes. You've got 6 kids now. And he's no longer doing campus. I should point that out.
You get to the point where the kids are like Mr. and Miss Sachs, and you've kind of lost that edge that you need for campus kids.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're bringing your kids to watch your, you know, flag football intramural game, it loses an element of coolness.
Yeah.
And, we transitioned to the business world.
Yeah. So. That is amazing. You aged out.
We aged out of the system.
Oh, which that's amazing. And I'm sure there's some great stories there. Do you know your Enneagram number?
I do. I feel like I finally, like, things clicked with me when I was introduced to the Enneagram. And I was like, oh my gosh, I make sense to myself for the first time in my life.
Yes.
So I'm an Enneagram 9, which is the peacemaker.
Mm-hmm.
And a perfect synopsis of that is in an old Julia Roberts movie called The Runaway Bride.
You don't know which eggs you want.
You don't know which eggs you want. And she would, like, get cold feet at the last minute and, like, leave her, you know, obviously her green at the altar. And when she would come in to order at this breakfast place, every time she you know, you could tell she was on a new guy because she would get whatever eggs they was getting. Which is very common for the 9. We're very passive and can be asleep to our own lives.
Mm.
But I learned I had a favorite color when I was like 44. I mean, I was like, what? This is crazy. So it's been really fun to learn about the strengths of my Enneagram number and then the pitfalls to avoid. So.
Yeah. And the 9 goes to
6 and stress.
6 and stress and 3.
And 3 in health.
In health. Mm-hmm. Okay. That is – okay, so – I love that analogy. I have always thought of the 9 instead of being a peace maker as more of a peacekeeper.
100%.
Like willing to keep the peace at all cost, even if it not in a health place, even at the detriment of your own preferences.
100%. Yeah. 100%. And so, that's probably another podcast for another day. But, and I've learned to unpack this in years of therapy, at the root of it is really rooted in selfishness, because I need everyone around me to be at peace so that I can be comfortable and at peace inside.
Yeah.
So it's just easier for me to make sure they're all doing their thing and me absorb it.
Yeah.
So that I can, you know, just numb that side of myself out and focus on whatever autopilot I want to run on.
And that resonates with me as a 2. I had to learn the art of, you're not okay, but I'm okay.
Yes.
Or I'm not okay, but you're okay, and we're okay. That's okay.
Yes.
There was a lot of dependency on my external world being manageable so that I could feel I was manageable.
Yes.
And so a lot of what I've had to learn in my relationships and relating is that I depended a lot on, I need them to be okay. And if they're not, there was this sense of, well, if they would just do this, then I'd be okay. Everything would be okay. Rather than the real work in therapy for me as well of unpacking, what does it look like to have it's separated. Mm-hmm. Like you're being you, your hula hoop is you and my hula hoop is me. So I resonate deeply with that as well. That's some powerful stuff.
Yes.
So we have you on the podcast because of that sweet boy Gideon that I got to be there for shortly after he was born.
Yes.
Because he has had a diagnosis and an experience that your family has had to go through, and I was hoping that you would share that with us.
Absolutely, absolutely. It was, we had a family vacation, and for anyone who knows me, it's kind of like my happy place to go to Blue Mountain Beach every summer with my parents, my brother and sister-in-law. They're all in the ministry, so they don't really get weekends and holidays.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like our time every summer to be with each other. We were coming off of COVID or out of COVID. I had a COVID senior, so his year had drastically changed and everything had been cut short. And Florida had just opened up. And I remember for the first time in my life, because as a 9, I put everyone else's needs in front of mine, feeling like I deserve this break.
Yeah.
I deserve this break. And I can't get there fast enough.
Yeah.
So because churches were closed, we had a Saturday, Sunday, and Monday full days on the beach, and it was glorious. I remember it feeling picture perfect. I also remember on that Monday, it was Memorial Day, the riots had started in Birmingham, and there was all of this civil unrest and heaviness and sadness, and we're watching on the news like our city being torn apart, and it's just like, what is going on? And we stayed up really, really late watching those until like 4 a.m.
Oh, wow.
So I was really tired the next day. And I remember when I got out there on the beach, I was like, I'm not refereeing anybody. I'm not getting out of my beach chair to go get your snack out of the cooler.
Yeah.
I'm not playing with anybody. Mm. I'm not catching hermit crabs. I'm going to sit in this chair and I'm going to read.
Yeah.
And I don't want anybody to bother me. It like, it was like. Perfect. I deserve this. And so that was my day. As you know, all my people were around me. It's beautiful, happy place. We stayed on the beach from probably 8 that morning till we came in. I mean, we were packing it up with the chair people like at 7 that evening.
Yeah.
We were in 2 different condos. So my parents, sister, and brother-in-law, because we're so big, we don't all fit in one.
Yeah.
We're in one on one floor, and then my nuclear family were on a floor under them. So we just hopped from kitchen to kitchen,
yeah,
exchanging where we would eat dinner. Gideon had gotten out of the shower, and he's how old? He's 7, almost 8. And he pulls on his little green terry cloth shorts and a green Nike dry fit shirt, horribly mismatched. And he had combed his hair. I mean, he looked like alfalfa. And he came out so proud. And he said, I got ready and I got my outfit on for pictures. I'm going to wear these for our beach pictures. And I was like, oh gosh, I think we're going to wear something better than that. Like that, no, we're not wearing that for beach pictures. Like, I was very in tune with my 8-wing and was very decisive on this particular day. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so he kind of was a little dejected and was like, oh, well, can I go upstairs to Walker and Honey and Papa's? And I was like, yes, you may go. And so my other kids were up there except for my oldest two. And from what we know, my nephew, Walker, who was 18 months older than Gideon, and Gideon were sitting on top of a bunk bed playing with their Legos, and my mom sent one of our other boys to tell them, wash their hands, it's time for supper. I was getting the casserole out in our beach room or whatever.
You were in your condo.
We were in our condo. Mm-hmm. They were in theirs, and the boys went in there to tell them to get down, and it was a big fancy bunk bed, like one of the queens on bottom, and then like a horizontal up top.
Yeah.
It didn't have a ladder like he is used to at home.
Yeah.
It was like really steep, looked like stairs. Mm-hmm. And so he stood up to walk down them like you would a staircase and realized this is too steep. And when he turn and go backwards, it's when he fell. Mm-hmm. The boys saw him fall and told us, they were able to tell us he had a seizure when he hit the ground. Mm-hmm. So I remember our sweet Josiah, who was 9 at the time, running into the condo frantically. I could still, it just gets me in my gut. I can still hear his little voice. Hurry, hurry, Gideon fell and he won't wake up. He fell off the bunk bed. And we were just like, what?
Yeah.
And I mean, I think I dropped the baked ziti on the floor and we just ran. And I remember him saying, don't go the elevator or the stairs are quicker. Mm. And as fast as my legs could carry me, we all ran up there. And when we got into the room, he was just laying on the ground, kind of curled in a fetal position, just looked like he was asleep.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, like, is there blood? Did he bust his head? Like, what is going on? And we just stood there begging him and begging. I remember begging Jesus to wake him up. Just please wake him up. Wake him up. And I remember the faces of all of my sweet family in the room, just almost with... I think it was probably a helplessness, just a gut-wrenching helplessness seeing the thing. And I remember looking at my dad saying, please pray, as if like his prayers would get there better than mine.
Yeah.
just, it was the most helpless feeling. And after a few minutes, he made a really funny sound. We think he was unconscious for 7 to 8 minutes. Mm. That's how long the 911 call was, which right. our other daughter was on with 911 while we were trying to get him to respond. And he started to cry, and we asked him if his head hurt, and he said, no, my thumb. His thumb. So we were just relieved. So the ambulance came, and he was talking. He had settled down. He was complaining about his thumb, and he had a little bit of a headache. So they were going to transport him to St. Vincent's Ascension, Emerald Coast, which is right by the outlets, if you're familiar yep. with the Sandestin area. Because it was COVID, only one parent could go. And so I hopped in the ambulance because I can rattle off their medical history in my sleep, their yeah. birthdays, their weight, if they're right. taking any medicines. Our sweet Sadler was a sophomore at the time, and she had been on about a 12-month journey of being diagnosed with dysautonomia in POTS. So when her blood pressure and her whatever would go crazy, she would pass out in posture, a lot like a seizure. Mm. So the boys knew that that's what it, looks what like. It looked like. Mm. We got to the in the ambulance. I remember the medic asking him all kind of questions because we were just trying to keep him awake.
Yeah.
You know, what are the names of your brothers and sisters and cousins? And he nailed it. I mean, you would never know anything was wrong with him. He even used his manners, Rachel. I mean,
oh, yes, he's Southern boy.
Yeah, I'm like, ooh, win for that one.
Yeah.
And so I really was hopeful that we would get there and come home with, like, on concussion protocol. We've had concussions before. I was really hopeful. So we had been there a while. It was just I remember them, let me back up, saying that they were trying to decide where to take us, either to the first hospital, which was Emerald Coast, or farther to Fort Walton, which was really maybe better equipped, but it was a longer drive.
Right.
So they called the ER physician on call, who happened to have a son Gideon's age, and he said, I'll see him, bring him on.
To the which one?
To the closest one.
Okay.
And by the grace of God, that's where we were when he went into respiratory failure. So we had been there for a little while. He was tired. And I asked the doctor, he's like, well, it's 9:30. He's been on the beach all day. And his body had an adrenaline dump. It's no surprise he's tired. And
yeah.
And so he was like, well, let's get your discharge papers or whatever. And he was kind of getting ready to let us go. And things went really south really quick. I remember looking at Gideon, and he had lost that brown color to his skin, and he was white as a sheet, and he wasn't waking up, and his lips were blue, and all of a sudden he just started vomiting. And from then on, it's just a whirlwind. I remember being very annoyed at the nurses. This is spicy Heather on this day. because he's like throwing up. He's got a what do you call it, a cervical collar, the like neck brace thing on that they put on him in an ambulance. And this is really graphic, but like he's throwing up. So it's like all just kind of stuck, and it's on him. And it's like, I'm like, can I get some help or some napkins or towel, like a bag, an Emesis bag, like anything? And they are ignoring me, and they're like digging in drawers and talking. But what I wasn't realizing is they had instantly gone into trauma mode.
Yeah.
From then, they rushed him back for a CT scan, and I remember seeing on the papers, intracranial hemorrhage, subdural blood pooling, epidural hematoma, traumatic brain injury, fractured skull, now with respiratory failure requiring mechanical breathing. And all of a sudden, my world collapsed. I remember the doctor asking me if there was anybody we could call, and I was like, my everybody's waiting to hear. Can you please put my husband on speakerphone and tell us at the same time? It just wasn't registering.
Right.
And so they were rushing Gideon to the trauma bay. If you're ever in those all glass rooms right by the nurse's desk, that's never a good place to be.
Yeah.
They were, fighting over what size tube to put down his throat because they don't typically treat pediatric patients. Graciously, the hospital being small and closer made an exception for Cord to come because I think a liability at that point.
I mean, they were
like, you need to take some deep breaths. I couldn't stay in the room, Rachel.
Yeah.
And that today even haunts me, that I wasn't strong enough to be there for him when I felt like he needed me most. I couldn't take it. Cord got there and he went right in, and he doesn't do medical things. That's me. That's my wheelhouse. Like, people pay me to keep them calm and to bring peace into chaotic situations. And here I was with my own little boy.
Yeah.
And I couldn't do that for him. Mm. And the amount of guilt I felt with that, on top of thinking the last words I said to him were criticizing his outfit that he was so proud of. And I remember they had cut his little shirt and thrown it away. It was wreck, obviously. But they folded those little green terry cloth shorts and handed them to me in a bag. And I didn't know whether to throw them away because it was the worst night of my life, or to keep them because that might have been the last thing I saw my little boy alive in. While they were waiting on the helicopters, we were begging them to let me go in the helicopter with them. So they had initially dispatched a larger helicopter, and it was taking forever. And I could hear them like screaming, you know, where are they? I mean, we've got to get him out of here. Just all the things. And then I heard the nurse say they had to turn around. They were having mechanical failure. It was starting to storm, and I remember being very upset. They said they're sending a smaller one from Gainesville Children's Shands, which is way far on the other side of the state.
Yeah,
they said the mom won't be able to go, which in hindsight was the best thing to happen because I was physically ill. I was like, I'm gonna throw up. Like everything I ever prided myself on being. All of my strengths that I brought into a birth room all of a sudden were out the window, and I didn't know what end was up. They flew him. They told us, they said, say anything you want to say to him. He can hear you. But we got to get him. The trauma team and the neurosurgeons are on standby. We got to get him quick.
Yeah.
And so there was this, you know, and the helicopter pilot was great. And they're so precise. He's like, I'll call you at 12:35 a.m. If you haven't heard from me by 12:37, you can worry.
Yeah.
But don't worry until it's, you know, they're so precise.
Yeah.
And the drive there felt like...
Where were they taking him? Where were they flying him?
Oh, I'm so sorry. They were flying him to Ascension, Pensacola, Sacred Heart, Pensacola.
Okay.
It was the closest pediatric trauma center.
Yeah.
So we didn't know in that time. We stood out there with the helicopter and watched them. You know, they kind of shoved him into the chopper right up front. Like he was on the, you know, ride of his life.
Yeah.
And we just stood there till we couldn't see it anymore and got in the car, and Cord drove as fast as he could legally drive. And I don't remember anything but him saying, we won't know anything until 12:35, close your eyes and rest. And that was a gift of mercy.
Yes.
And as I woke up when we were exiting off of I-10 to Pensacola, and I remember hearing, the only song I remember hearing was Waymaker. And I had not heard it before. Even when you don't feel it, he's working. Even when you can't see it, he's working. And then we ran in, and, you know, it's the middle of the night. Everything is just chaos. Fast forward, I don't even know how long, and his bleeds were stable. They were going to extubate him. He had to pass a COVID test first again. It was a scary time, and nobody knew what they know now. Again, they made an exception for Cord to be with me and Gideon both, which was the grace of God, because I could not have made it by myself. Again, I was the liability. Gideon was fine.
Nor should you have to.
And they got ready to extubate him, and I couldn't stay in the room. Mm. I, toward the end when they were getting ready to wake him up and let the medicine wear off, he would have moments of like consciousness where he would open his eyes wide, of like full of terror, and be trying to get the tubes out of his throat and trying to rip the IVs out of his arm. Side note, our sweet Ellie texted us and said, don't forget to tell him about his thumb. And it was fractured. So
he was right.
He was right. His thumb was hurting. When they got ready to wake him up, they prepared. They said, we don't know what the damage will be. We don't know anything. You know, we knew it was on his right temporal lobe and his right frontal lobe, which was causing the left-sided weakness. But we didn't know if he would know who he was, who we were. We didn't know if he could talk. We didn't know if he could walk. We knew he had movement, but we didn't know if everything would work together. The brain is such an amazing organ. But as soon as they extubated him, he looked around and he looked at his arm, which had like this massive, you know, cotton and then an ACE bandage over it, because they have to let the swelling die down before they put a cast on it. And he looked at his arm and he looked at me and he looked at Cord and he said, can I get this wet? And I was like, what?
Can you go swim?
He wanted to go swim. That's the first words he said. The first words he said. I'm like, do you know you almost died?
Yeah.
You had a brain injury and you woke up. You want to know if you can get that wet? Okay.
He's at the beach. He wants to get in the water.
Yes.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm on vacation. Yeah. I'm like, you just slept 4 days of vacation away.
Exactly.
This is like, whatever. So in a nutshell, God was very gracious to give us our little boy back, which I think is another layer of grief that I have, because for so long, even still today, I'll find myself really sad, especially on days of like IEP meetings, or when we tell him again he can't play that sport or he can't do something because of his brain injury. And he's, you know, he'll ask us questions, you know, am I dumb because my head broke open and my brain spilled out? And we're like, what are you talking about? I said, that's what the kids at school told me. And so it's those little tiny deaths, like lowercase d, that you still feel, even though you have this on the outside, walking, talking, smiling kid in front of you. And so I felt really guilty that I was sad when I had my baby.
And that, and tell me, he's how old now?
He is 12.
He's 12.
Yes.
So, okay. Wow. Yes, five.
It'll be 5 years this June.
Wow.
Yes.
So that, you've mentioned so much that I want to just go right into, namely that guilt, and how do you feel about that now? You're almost 5 years later. Like, how are you approaching that sense of knowing that you at the time weren't able to? Have you met yourself with grace there?
I'm learning to. I am very much a work in progress. And I think I mentioned to you earlier, it's like I don't have a nice, neat bow to tie it up with. Yes, God gave us our child back alive. But we're still, our lives look totally different than we thought they would. He won't go to college. He won't. I mean, we're hoping we go from, you know, hoping he maybe could go to a junior college, to hoping a trade school, to hoping, oh my gosh, can he graduate with a normal diploma? We don't have that guarantee, because you have to have all these requirements in Alabama, and understandably so. But I feel like I'm far enough out that I can look back at myself with compassion and just say, like, you didn't know what you didn't know. You were doing the best you could.
Yes.
That's hard, because I don't like that answer. I wish I could go back and change it, but I can't. So I'm learning to meet things with compassion. It's easy. Sometimes my parents will ask, what would you tell Ellie or Sadler, our girls, if this were their situation? And I can spout off anything and mean it from my soul. But for myself, not so much.
In the quiet hours when we face ourselves, it's how do we meet ourselves there? Because I can give you the same thing. I can give everybody else the perfect response.
Right.
For what I know is the truth. but holding that truth for myself is, mm-hmm. it can be wobbly.
Yes.
So what do you think in the ways of relating to your new world that has slowly, it just reveals itself every day as could be new and every year is new. How do you think this has impacted the way that you show up to parenting or to your relationship with Cord? And like, in what ways has this shifted things for you?
Again, it's not, I am very much a work in progress, and I'm about 4 years behind where I would want to be. So this is all still relatively new. I'm still exercising these muscles.
Yeah.
I do think, especially as my kids have faced by now a lot of heartaches, and some deep loss of their own in different ways. You know, it doesn't matter what the loss is, big or small. A grief is a grief.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm able to, whereas before I might want to rush through to make sure everybody gets to a good place before.
Yeah.
You know, I feel unsteady, but now I feel a little more like, just breathe with it. Mm. Like when you feel that wave of sadness.
Yeah.
Feel it and release it and move on. Like, don't pretend it away. Don't, you know.
Yeah.
Try to numb yourself. So, and even learning to do that in my marriage, just being more compassionate with Cord as he faces different obstacles.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's probably where it has changed things the most in a positive way.
Yeah.
I can list a lot of ways. Negative, a lot of losses.
And you mentioned the wave, so of course the doula brain goes off.
Yes.
Going, that's what we would call contractions as waves. Yep. And being able to handle those. There's, to me, I have found there's so much that is parallel for doula work and going through birth, mm-hmm. I should say, or the labor process. That makes so much sense to grief. And in fact, when I first thought of having you on the podcast, I was like, we could just come on and talk about doula work and how it relates to grief, and we'd have a whole podcast on
Absolutely.
But that's exactly, it feels like for my own experience with grief is learning how to, just as you said, allow what's present to be present, mm-hmm. with compassion. And to know that it's going to pass. Like, mm-hmm. That's the beauty and the pain of life, is that nothing is ever permanent.
Absolutely.
Nothing. There's impermanence everywhere. And so there's this sense of, how can you meet this experience compassionately to allow what you're feeling to be felt and to be valid, and that you don't have to compare it, and you don't have to... you don't have to beat yourself up either through the experience. Yeah. You're just allowing it to be. I'm curious what it was like parenting your other kids going through the same experience, like their grief, and parenting through their grief. How is that? How was that process?
Yeah, I really, goodness, I have, like, I really was blown away to see, or really to hear in hindsight, how each of their personalities came out in the situation.
Yeah.
Our oldest firstborn is probably a 9-2. Mm. He's just steady, laid back. I mean, we're kind of like, will you get in a hurry, please?
Yeah.
Please. And we, let me backtrack and say, about a year to the day, we went back to the same condos, not the same rooms. I couldn't go back in that one, but the same unit. I mean, the same building.
Yeah.
And on the anniversary, so we go the same week every year, we just kind of had like a family powwow and talked about what we were thankful for and what we remembered. Mm. And had them have a time of affirmation for each other.
Yeah.
Or just to say what they remembered, and to hear like little popcorn around the room. Like, one of the boys said, I was so thankful for Jeremiah, our oldest, his steadiness and stepping up and leading. And another one said, I was thankful for Ellie's, like, nurturing. Like, she's like a mom. Like, I think Yeah. One of the boys slept in the middle of she and Sadler. Yeah. One of the little brothers, because they were unnerved. And,
yeah.
Another one was thankful for, you know, someone's, you know, being kind and patient. And for Sadler's, just her prayers. She just has a sweet, sweet relationship with the Lord. It's just kind of beyond her years. And, and then the little boys, they had so much to be thankful for, but they were scared. Mm-hmm. And they had some survivor guilt that we had to work through.
Yeah.
Just feeling like they had echoed one, and it didn't come out right away. It was like when it was safe and everybody was okay enough, a couple of months later, you're tucking them in and it's quiet at night. And and their little voice cracks, and I think it was my fault. Because I told him to come wash his hands.
Yeah.
Or I think it was my fault because I was telling him, hurry, hurry, hurry.
Yeah.
Being silly. And there's, and I'm like, you know, mom feels the same way. I feel like it was my fault because guess what? I wasn't there.
Yeah.
Which is another thing I've had to work through in a lot of therapy is if I only would, if onlys. There's some of the cruelest voices I hear.
It's just it's this inner critic voice. And that's so common in grief that people, it's hard to recognize. Because I've tried to explain it this way for myself. There is the grief, the loss, and then there's the story that I have about the loss or the grief or the experience. So it's sometimes they're muddled together. Like there's a genuine feeling that I feel, this sadness over the obvious loss.
Right.
But then I'm also having to navigate the very real inner critic or story that I've attached to that loss. And it's not just in death or in these very obvious losses, but it's, as John Onwuchekwa says, the ambiguous grief in the places that people don't know why you would be sad about something. Right.
You should be happy. Yeah. Look at your blessings.
Yeah. For you, like, well, I'm sure you've had the people that at least he's still with you. At least he's still, which is, by the way, not helpful.
It's not helpful. And you want to look at him and say, do you not think I know that? You not think? I wrestle with that same question every night as a believer. Why I can't, my faith can't make me a stronger Christian, or I can't have more faith.
Yeah.
I think the other way that it changed my parenting, and this is a negative way, but it's something that's still really hard for me, is it stole a lot from me. Mm-hmm. I went from, you know, being nerve-sided, kind of nervous, kind of excited to launch Jeremiah to college and to move him into Auburn to I just getting up and facing the day was monumental, and I just held on till bedtime, because all of the sudden when you have a trauma and when you're an Enneagram 9, you go to 6, which is stress,
the worry
and the worrier. And, so there was danger around every corner. I mean, something is innocuous as a bunk bed almost, you know, fall almost took the life of my kid. Well, what about football? Well, what about the one getting behind the wheel for the first time? Or what if you you're eating popcorn, I need to run to the store, what if you choke? That's not who I was. And it was this weird worrier, absent, fog-stricken shell of a mom that they got. And especially Ellie's senior year, because she was starting her senior year. Jeremiah, they're great apart. So that was full of, you know, getting in state out of school for a year between therapies and doctor appointments and all the things. And healing your brain is
– it takes a lot.
Yes. There's no roadmap. Every brain injury is different. And he might be crying because – he's overstimulated, or he might be crying because his head hurts because it's too much learning at that moment and we need to take a break. Or he might be crying because he's, you know, an 8-year-old
that got told no,
fallen boy. He can't have the 18th fruit roll up, you know? I mean, like, it was like I second guessed everything. Whereas before in my parenting, I was like, you know, this super chill, like people would, And I guess I wore it, if I'm being honest, this is not something I'm proud of, but I wore it as a badge of honor that...
Well, it was a strength.
I could be calm. Yeah. And I could, you know...
I mean, look at the work you're doing as a doula, that the time you're helping moms remain calm in a very stressful...
In a very chaotic time.
That came naturally. Yes. So all of a sudden, it does not feel... And it's out of body.
It was out of body. I didn't recognize myself. Mm. And I'm still... reacquainting myself. I'm still a little bit unmoored and trying to figure out what my role is, what I do next, where we go from there. But I think that is something that that might be unrecognized in the grieving process in the family unit is how much it steals from your family. Like, gone was the fun mom that y'all want waffles for dinner? I don't feel like cooking. Let's eat waffles for dinner.
Yeah.
It's bedtime. You want to have a dance party before we go to bed?
Yeah.
You know, I don't care if you stay up another hour, but whatever. Yeah. You know, just nothing really fazed me. I mean, we had had a lot of close calls. We had, Cord and I had 4 miscarriages. We had lost babies. We'd gone to Uganda on a mission trip, and the missionary we went to stay with died of a specific strand of malaria while we were there.
Wow.
And the next day, Jeremiah starts running fever and is diagnosed with the exact same strand of malaria. And we have to watch his fever. If his fever got to 104, we had to medevac out of the bush of Uganda into Germany to the closest Air Force base.
Wow.
Yes. All that to say, we had done some hard things. We had seen some hard things, but nothing rattled us like this. And it takes a toll on the whole family.
It does. And I even think about, like, the fact that you said the fog and where you felt like you were for a very long time. The process, and I think this is so helpful for people to know, that when you experience big T trauma, and even little T, because it depends on what you've experienced at that time, your capacity, when you meet something like that, it takes a toll on the physical body to be able to process all the change, all that's required of you while you're also processing your own grief, your own adjusting. So it makes sense to me as an outsider looking in. I'm like, oh yeah, that makes sense why. But when I'm looking at my own life and that feeling of like when I... There are times when I'm experiencing the depths of grief and I feel like, well, I should be past this by now, which is, again, not helpful, but you shouldn't. There's no shoulds. Brene Brown, we don't should on ourselves.
Yes. I love that.
But it's hard for us to accept how long it might stay, how long that grief visits, or even just the time it takes to adjust for our own sake, or what it shapes and shifts in us, is powerful that you're allowing that. And like you, I love when you say it's messy. It's when I first approached you and I said, you know, I want to talk, you're like, well, I don't have a bow to tie on this story. And I'm like, great. I don't need a bow, because so many of us are living the day to day without the bows, without the bow tying on the end to make the messy seem like it's concise and pretty. It is real. It is real life. And in that space, the people want to know, okay, how do I live in light of that? This is the reality. And so that leads me to ask, in what ways have you met this new reality that feel like gracious to you, that feel like coming home to your heart, coming home to just the new reality and what that looks like, that feels like it's helpful for you?
That's a really good question, and I'm not sure I have an answer to it, because I'm still trying to find my way back to myself. But counseling has been invaluable. Like, I remember, and this is part of the story too, but the week we got home from Gideon's accident and we were discharged from the hospital and able to come back to Birmingham, my mother-in-law had a routine procedure to drain some, I think they called it sludge, that for the medical word, out of near her bile duct. And in the process, they punctured her what's called an ampulla evader, which is like another little piece. Who knew? Yeah. I mean, I can tell you female anatomy.
Yeah.
And it weighs down really well, but I don't know all the stuff.
Yeah.
And was found to have a very rare kind of cancer. And in puncturing in the procedure, that was like a 0.8 chance it would happen, it spilt the cancer cells all in her body. So she had to have a massive, we'd lost Cord's dad to cancer already.
Wow.
We were younger in our marriage, and all of a sudden his mom was diagnosed with stage 3 pancreatic cancer.
Wow.
And we didn't have a bucket to put things in that were being hurled at us between COVID and Gideon's near death and now his mom. And we went to the church and met with a sweet pastor who was there at the time, who used to be a cop and specialized in trauma. He named it for me. He said, what you're experiencing is trauma. And I will expect that you will probably have some PTSD when this is settled. And, you know, it takes some time for the natural things to settle. And Cord didn't have PTSD from Gideon's accident. I did. I don't know what's different. We both were in the same place, watched the same things. For someone to name that was huge, because then I could give myself a little bit more grace and I could learn, okay, this is normal for someone whose brain is functioning in a state of hyperarousal. And I could then seek out help to help, you know, process what we had experienced.
Well, and that reminded me, because this is a point I think I was trying to make earlier. When you're on high alert like that, when you're on constant alert for danger, that's exhausting.
It is absolutely, it felt like jet lag every day, no matter how long I slept. And the littlest things would wipe me out. The littlest things, like not having an ingredient for what I was going to make for dinner that night. It's like I couldn't problem solve anymore.
Any executive function is done.
And you talk about trying to move a kid into a college and get another one ready with all the things that come with a senior year. I was drowning.
Yeah.
But it helped.
To name it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then being able to name, which is so powerful, to be able to name it. What ways did people show up for you that were helpful?
Helpful.
Yeah.
That is easy. When we were in the hospital in Pensacola, two friends, Luke Leonard, got in his car and drove through the night just to sit in the parking lot and pray outside the hospital for Gideon. And then Misty Purcell has family in Birmingham. I mean, in Pensacola, drove from Birmingham and said, what can I do?
Yeah.
What can I do? And when she got there, we went to a hotel, because ideally I was going to sleep. One of us was going to stay at the hospital and one of us was going to stay at the hotel. So at least one parent was getting rest.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to leave.
Yeah.
And then Cord probably didn't want to leave me or Gideon. He's like, she might end up in the psych ward. So we went to the hotel and she said, what do you want to do? I said, I don't even know. I'm so tired. I think I might be hungry, but I'll throw up if I eat. She said, what if you lay down? I'll stay awake and hold your phone so that you can turn your brain off and lay down. And I think however long I slept was not substantial amount, but it was like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That okay, I can breathe again.
Yeah.
And then she's like, let's go to Target. You don't have clothes. You don't have a toothbrush. You don't have, you know, Gideon will need clothes to put on. He's going to, very practical things. But perhaps the most was, we looked at each other between the time of when I had woken up and when we were going to head towards Target. And it was like this. I don't know why this is making me emotional. It's really kind of funny. But it was like we were seeing it for the first time and like, oh my gosh. And we both burst into tears and just held on to each other. It was kind of like, is this really happening? And her tears were so powerful. Like, I felt seen. I felt not so alone.
Yeah.
I felt her compassion, which helped me be compassionate. And then she, you know, the next minute we could be, you know, making fun of me tripping out of the elevator or something and on our way. You know, it's just a good balance of just an authentic friend that you feel safe with. Another thing was practical things. Like, we came home and our life group had cleaned our house and they had provided meals for like 2 weeks. So every other night, like, just to not have to think. You know, I'm every time Gideon would walk or get up somewhere or make a noise in his sleep, we had to worry, is he having a seizure? Is he, you know, what is this? His gait was very unsteady because of his left side weakness. And so it was exhausting to, you know, in the night, you aren't sleeping soundly because you're trying to have an ear out for your kid. Yeah. And then you don't want to wake up and think, what do I need to get from the store? It's very practical.
Yeah. The mental load, somebody helping you take the mental load.
The mental load. Yeah. Yes. Helping with kids, helping, you know, transport them, getting them out of the house to do something fun. Because their world had been interrupted too.
Yeah. Which I think is really powerful for anybody listening, that if you know somebody walking through something like that, to know, even if they have other kids, like just offer.
Yes.
Just offer to, hey, can we take them out? Can we take them bowling? Can we take them to Starbucks, whatever it is that they want, on a hike, whatever.
I remember mom, one of Gideon's friends, and mom, she was so brave. She got him, because he had his arm in a cast. He couldn't watch screens. He couldn't play any kind of games with the brain injury.
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do with him all summer? It's hard to keep a little boy from running, from jumping on a trampoline, from, you know, they can't watch screens. And so she went and got some puzzles and some other little like shape games and stuff and brought her son over with that bag to give to Gideon. And it was so precious because it taught her son, like, we're going to enter in.
Yeah.
The messy parts, even if it's scary. And for Gideon, he was just happy to see a buddy.
Yeah, know? Absolutely. To see a peer. Mm-hmm. That's powerful. Well, and I say on every podcast that that grief is universal. And so no matter our background or our faith experience, that we all experience grief. And we do so in our ways that mean something to us and that matter to us. And so I'm curious on the faith aspect, how your faith was impacted by this experience as well.
When I saw this question, I was like, oh boy, this one's a doozy. Before I go into the faith aspect, let me backtrack. One thing you asked me that I had never thought about was, what were some things that were unhelpful?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
One of the biggest things that stood out to me was when people would try to, like, rationalize with me. They mean well.
Yeah.
And they're trying to speak into, like, one instance comes to mind was with my brother, who is a spiritual giant. I love him dearly. He is very rational and logical. And I was freaking out over a kid's Christmas present because it was something they could get hurt on. And he was like, Heather, chill. Take a deep breath. God's sovereign. And I was like, you can't rationalize with me right now.
No.
You can't logic it away. I love you, Wes, if you listen to this. And he apologized later. He was like, you know, probably wasn't the best timing. But don't, like, I get there's a time and a place to say, get unstuck.
Yeah.
But maybe a better thing, how can I help you through this feeling? Like, do you need to move your body? That's huge for me, walking. Like, if I feel all the angst dwell, like, just bubbling up inside, I'm like, I got to get out of here and walk, which is really funny because you can't pay me to run to save my life. I mean, you can't. I hate exercise. I hate anything to do. And for me to sit here and say, like, my walk is, like, my sanity in the day, it's comical. But the Lord has a sense of humor.
Yeah.
Back to the faith question. My faith was dealt a severe blow. It made me think of a C.S. Lewis quote that said, it's not that I don't believe God will do what's best. It's that I wonder how much it will hurt in the process. And I think my belief in God, who he is, who Jesus is, like the core of my faith, was not in question. But God's character was. He didn't feel very good. He didn't feel very safe. He didn't feel very kind. Yeah. Sometimes.
Yeah.
On good days, I could tell you all the things he did and the ways he used a song on the radio.
Yeah.
On the way to Pensacola. Or this precious African-American janitor letting us back in the hospital in the side door that stopped and prayed over us. Mm. The most beautiful prayer. I can find those things. Yeah. But I was really, my heart was really cold.
Yeah.
It was very cynical. I remember there, you know, it was still summer COVID. Things were maybe or maybe not open, but we were having still a lot of family time from quarantine.
I mean, yeah.
We had kind of had a lot anyway. But we had tried to watch The Chosen back in quarantine, and we watched like one episode, and I was like, oh, this is weird. This is hokey. I don't do Christian stuff like that. Like, I know that sounds terrible.
No, it doesn't.
But I mean, sometimes it can be subpar and really bad acting. And I was like, I can't. I just can't. That's you know, that's really cringy. One of our kids wanted to turn it on one day, and we turned it on one night, and it was the first episode, and at the end, Mary Magdalene is wrestling with her demons, and she was going to grab alcohol in the tavern, and you don't see Jesus the entire first episode until the last 30 seconds,
right?
And he puts his hand on her, and he says, "That's not for you," and when he embraced her, like, something broke in me, and I remember just sobbing. And I think that I was able to see the humanity of Jesus where I had not considered that aspect of him before. I still, you know, that was great. That was, we did start watching The Chosen. I love it. I mean, like, for a while I was
got in, you turned around.
Yeah, got me turned around. I was in EMDR therapy, and one of the exercises was visualizing being in my happy place, my safe place. Well, I was like, well, that's screwed, because that was the beach and that's where the accident happened. So I don't even know where my happy place is. And she was like, well, make it further down the beach, whatever. But I was to picture, you know, she had me list people that were safe to me and what it would be like for me to be back in that place, just sitting on the sand. And with all of them around me, not staring at me, backs towards me, almost in a protective circle, and for Jesus to be meeting me in that. And it was a powerful image. And so I made Jesus from The Chosen my screensaver, to my kids' mortification. Like, we went to Auburn for the first time and took Jeremiah and a bunch of friends out, and I had my phone sitting on the table at the Mexican restaurant, and they were like, is that Jesus on your phone?
On your phone. And I was like, and this actor, he has literally, like, he will have people come up to him. I've watched a special that he was in, and he talked about it, of the phenomena of people actually, like, associating him. Like, it's hard for them in the real world to approach him and not treat him as if he were Jesus.
I believe it.
Yeah, because he is a powerful representation,
he
I think.
He really is.
He just did a phenomenal job, but as a caveat really, on that. He
really does.
Yeah, he did a great job on that show.
I don't remember the question. It was about my faith. Back to that, like, just seeing that no matter how cynical I got or how annoyed with God I got or how I just stiff-armed him, like, his pursuit of me didn't stop. And it was like that couple was seeing the humanity of Jesus with remembering that he was a man of sorrows. Like, Jesus wept a lot. He and had a lot of joy too.
Right.
But he knew the outcome. Like, he knows how this all turns out, and he still cried.
Yeah.
And something about that, I don't know how to say it, something about it just brought my defenses down. And made me want to kind of come a little closer. And it's funny the way that the Lord will pursue you. I mean, through a Taylor Swift song.
Like, this is why I love I love the concept of I don't know if you've read, I know it was considered such a controversy in the evangelical church for years, but the book The Shack. because William P. Young creates this story that basically just goes to prove a truth that I had mm-hmm. known through my own faith walk and faith deconstruction, faith reconstruction, mm-hmm. was God will present himself to you in a way your nervous system can handle. Mm. And that is through a donkey, a Taylor Swift song, yeah. a movie, a show, anything that he uses everything to be able to communicate his desire to be close and to be known. And I just think that is just, when you said that through a Taylor Swift song, I'm like, yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Fun fact, the big black lady that plays the role of God, the father in the shack, she was in my safe circle at the beach with Jesus from the church.
She was. Oh, my goodness.
I love that maternal. Yes. Like.
Yeah. I love
bear
that.
You up. Just. I just loved it.
Yeah, that's powerful.
But yeah, I guess that's all that my nervous system can handle.
Yes, yeah.
I also just, I think, have learned a lot, too, just about something we probably don't do well in evangelical circles, and that's lament, which is to express our grief and sorrow, but with a trust that God is still in it.
Yeah.
And just recognizing that I can't numb my whole self down or there's nothing.
Yeah.
You don't just numb the hard parts of your life. You numb it all. It's an all or nothing. Yep. And so just recognizing that there's room for both.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. You can't numb the pain without also numbing the joy. And it's a painful lesson. And I feel like I'm constantly having to growing in that, in accepting the duality, that it's okay. It's okay. There's both existing at the same time.
Yes.
So what would you say to kind of close this out? There's two ways I want to go about it. I want to say, what would you say to Heather 4 years ago that you would want her to know? But I also...
Oh, that's hard.
I didn't prep you, Rachel, for that one. But I also, what would you want? Because you're going to be able to say it for others easily, because I would too. What would you want others to know that might be experiencing an experience that does all of these things? It may not look the same way, but it jolts you, it shakes your life, it shakes your faith, it shakes all of you. What would you want them to know?
That's a great question. I would want them to know that he's enough. He's enough for your fears. He's enough for your worries. He's enough for your doubt. He's enough. Yeah. He can handle it. I would want them to know that there's help, that a good therapist is invaluable.
Yeah.
Someone that can help you unpack it. I think that's definitely one of the reasons why I've come out of this with my faith still intact. It's just having just godly shepherds to help me figure it out and to teach me to show compassion to myself.
Yeah.
That makes me think of a Brené Brown quote. I know you know it, but it's what she said. I thought faith would be like an epidural and would take the pain away. Have you said this before?
No, I haven't. What is this?
Oh, it's so good. Oh, my gosh.
You're telling me something new. Yeah.
My gosh. She said, I thought faith would be like an epidural and it would take the pain away. But it turns out faith is the midwife who sits beside you in it. And that's...
Wow.
That's the summary of my story.
Yeah.
If I could tell myself anything, I would tell just probably what I told my girls recently and their different heartaches is breathe through it. It'll pass.
Yeah.
It'll pass.
It's
hard. It sucks. It's not forever.
Yeah.
You will have joy again. But be a good steward of the pain. I wasn't a good steward initially. I just wanted it to go away. I just wanted to survive.
Yeah.
And I think I could say to that Heather, it's okay. You're doing the best you can.
Yeah.
In time, you'll learn to be a good steward of the pain.
Which looks like what to you?
It looks different every day. Yeah. I think it's staying aware of... Checking in with my nervous system, nines are notorious for falling asleep to themselves. Like, we can notice everything around us and strengths and weaknesses about so many people and opinions and viewpoints, and hold space for all of it and not know what kind of eggs we like or what color is our favorite. So just just having to come back into myself and like, okay, my core is really tight right now. My heart is racing. What is this?
Yeah.
Like, for a while, and this is part of the PTSD party favor that nobody wants. it's like you lose the ability to determine your emotions. So after the accident, we love Auburn football in our family. We love football in general.
I allow you in my
Thank
house.
Thank you. But I know. I can hold space.
Okay, I'll just say roll tide. Just one time.
I really respect Nick Saban. He's the GOAT.
I'm so sorry.
We were so excited to go to the first Auburn game because the last season you couldn't go. You watched it on TV and the students were spaced apart. And we got in that, you know, stadium and the football players started tackling and all of a sudden a jolt of fear went through my body and my legs went weak. My throat goes, I'm going dry and I know that feeling, I'm going to have a panic attack. I'm either going to throw up or I'm going to burst into ugly tears and I don't know which it'll be.
Yeah.
And here I am stuck in the middle of 80,000 people and this is about to happen. I didn't know until I got probably a year or two on the other side of that when you're in a state of hyperarousal and you're in a state of trauma, you can't decipher, oh, that's excitement. That adrenaline's excitement. You're excited to be there.
Yeah.
It's fun. This is fun.
Yeah.
It's not, there's danger, there's fear. I'm looking down the stadium stairs. Okay, what if somebody trips and they have a head injury and hit their head on the concrete? Like, I couldn't watch scary movies, couldn't watch exciting movies.
Yeah.
I had to be real. I mean, Rachel, I was probably like a, 80-year-old living my best life in a retirement home. I could do puzzles. They were mindless. I love to read. I couldn't read because I couldn't hold my focus.
Yeah.
I didn't want to watch a show. I mean, it was like, well, I guess I'll sit here and see that. I could do a puzzle. It feels like progress, but I'm not exuding a lot of energy.
Yes.
I'm like,
but can I tell you, on a daily basis, people listening to this, if somebody asked me and said, Rachel, what do you do when you're overwhelmed or when you're shut down? And when I'm in the survival mode, I'm like doom scrolling. That's what I'll do. I'll find myself just doom scrolling.
Yes.
And it's and so common among people, but it's one of those where if in the moment, which you mentioned awareness, if I can be aware that I might be doing a behavior that's linked to something else that might be linked to an experience I'm either avoiding or that I'm overwhelmed by or whatever that looks like, that awareness is the first step to go, okay, this behavior is linked to, I need to pay attention to something.
Exactly.
What am I needing to observe? You said my chest gets tight, my heart's racing, stomach's hurting, throat's closing up. These are all cues to let us know that something is happening internally that we need to pay attention to. And it's an invitation for that. And so,
that's a beautiful way to say it. It's an invitation to show up for ourselves.
Yeah.
And say, how can I serve you?
Yeah.
And that can look a lot of different ways. It can be, your blood sugar might be low, go eat a snack.
Yeah.
Take a nap, you're tired.
Right.
Move your body, Heather. Get outside, move your body, get some blood flow to your brain, give it something to do besides freak out over what if scenarios.
Right.
But, so, yeah.
And nothing, and that I just want to state, nothing in your external world changes. It is not about changing the external world. You can't prevent the person falling from down the stairs, the players getting hurt on the field, choosing to go out there and do that.
Uh-huh.
It's the focus then goes internal. What can I do to soothe what's happening internally to the response of this past experience I have that is now on this present, my present world? And I think that's powerful. I could not have agreed more about being that awareness to your internal world. Is there anything else?
I don't think so. I just to jump on that thought train, like we had both voiced our common ground of like needing our kids' worlds or other people to be okay. But, like, I think that enlarges our capacity for I can still be okay, even if you're not. I don't have to have an end of the world come apart because your heart is broken.
Yeah.
I can be strong for you.
Yeah.
You can breathe through. It'll pass. Yeah. I can hold space while you do. So it can make us better friends, better parents.
Yes.
Better stewards.
Yeah. I love that. Goodness gracious. Thank you so
much. Oh, my goodness. You're going to have to edit the mess
no,
out of this.
No, I'm not. This is amazing. Like, and you're like covered confetti. In paper.
I mean, oh, my gosh. I'm such a mess.
No, it's perfect. I think that is, I think that's just a...
It's a
coping. ADD. Yeah, it's like ADHD.
Yeah, I can be at a restaurant and I'll tie my straw paper in as many. I'll see how many knots I can get in.
Yeah,
it, I'm weirdly.
Well, you wait. You don't do the thing where you tie and see if somebody's thinking about you.
No, that sounds more fun.
I just went to eighth grade for that. But yeah, we would tie. You tie a straw and you act like you're going to pull it, the paper, and then you think of the person and then you pull it real quickly. And if they're thinking about you, it comes out straight. And if they're not, there's a knot. Yeah, so it's a bummer. It's a very accurate strategy.
Don't think I'm not going to go home and try that.
Oh, my word. I'm ridiculous. Okay, I want to ask a question because I said I was going to do this at the end of my podcast. I was going to start asking this. Okay, before you leave us, can you tell me the last meal that you've had or location or the person you were with or all three? That was most memorable, the last most, like it was an amazing meal or it was an amazing conversation or people or it was the location that you were at or it met all three.
Oh, that's fun.
It's hard to think.
Probably the one that stands out most to me is at our house in the kitchen with everybody was like under the same roof for once in a
miracle.
Yes, a small miracle in itself. We had steak. And Gideon, ironically, was feeling some big feelings.
Uh-huh.
As the gentle parents would say. And was mad at somebody because, who knows, I don't even remember.
Yeah.
And he got really upset and took his steak and went and sat on the floor in another room to eat it. And it became comical.
Yes.
Because we're all like, oh my gosh. Like you could just see, he didn't have anything to cut it with, so... He's just got this like filet mignon with his fork stabbed in it. And he's like trying to eat it like a, I don't know.
Yeah, that's amazing.
He did come back to the table and we laughed a lot. But
yeah, I love that.
Family meals usually go one of two ways in our house.
They
go into some kind of engaging conversation and someone may or may not end up in tears. Mm-hmm. Or it goes into just inappropriate humor.
Chaos. Yeah. Yeah, I think we have the same type of brood.
Yeah,
very much so. All right. Well, I am so grateful that you were here.
Thank you for having me.
That you shared your story with us. And anybody could find you on social media. On Instagram if they had questions or wanted to talk to you about.
Please,
I know you wouldn't mind them reaching out.
I'm an open book.
Yeah.
If you can't tell.
Yeah. Which I love, which is why I wanted you on here. And so dream come true. Thank you again. All right, everybody. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.